CB Radio Interactive, giving you more chances to win. And win big. Win big. Win big.
Hi, could I speak with Bruce, please?
Speaking.
Bruce, this is Jonathan Rosen calling you from ACB Radio Interactive.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. A while ago, you entered the GW Micro competition, you may remember, and you won yourself a talking clock.
I certainly do.
And you also got into the draw for a copy of Window Eyes Professional. And I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that, courtesy of GW Micro, you are the winner of Window Eyes Professional.
Fantastic.
Yes, it is you.
Great.
You have won that screen reader. It's a wonderful package, works in all kinds of versions of Windows. And GW Micro is going to be sending that to you in the next little while.
Oh, thank you so much.
Congratulations to Bruce Taves of Canada, the grand winner in our Window Eyes Professional giveaway. And congratulations to all of our winners who will be receiving their prizes in the next little while. Thanks to GW Micro, the sponsors of the Eye Opener promotion. And stay tuned, because there are even more exciting ways to win on the way.
For all the wonderful personalities and great music, what's the place to listen to?
ACBRI.
Good on ya.
Don't risk the disappointment of missing a great ACB radio program. Join our announcements list today. Receive email about upcoming programs on all our channels and new features. To join, send a blank email now to announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
That's announce-subscribe at acbradio.org.
Or visit our website. Announcements about ACB radio delivered to you direct. The way to stay in touch with ACB radio.
ACB radio.
And welcome to another edition of Blind Line. I'm Jonathan Mosen. This is your original interactive talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired, and I hope that, especially if you're listening in the Northern Hemisphere, that you're having a wonderful summer break. I listen with some envy to people talking about being on vacation and not doing much of anything. Well, we're looking forward to December and January, when this part of the world will be having its summertime as well. Won't that be lovely? Going to be talking about some interesting things later in the program. We will, of course, have an open forum where you can raise anything that's on your mind. But before then, somebody who I'm very pleased to have on the program, because we can talk about any number of things. We can talk about technology and a number of books that he's written on that subject. We can also talk about one specific kind of technology that's attracting a lot of interest, and we'll come to that a little bit later. But to introduce Joe Lazzaro, first of all. Joe, very nice to have you on the show.
Thank you, Jonathan. How's it going?
Oh, really? Well, I hear that you've had Brian and Kim to dinner.
Yes, and they did eat us out of house and home.
Oh, man, they do that, though, especially Brian.
Well, he keeps telling me he's on a diet.
Yeah, he keeps telling me that.
He has another slice of pizza. So, that's all right. I'm hypocritical, too.
You're hypocritical. You know, you've got a pretty profound knowledge of and experience in technology, having a number of published works under your belt. How did you get interested in
technology? I don't have a social life.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I know the feeling. How did you get interested in the whole technology thing?
Mainly by accident. I was blinded when I was about 15 years old. And I was a blind college student, obviously, and I really didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I read a newsletter. Actually, my girlfriend, who is now my wife, read me a newsletter about a guy named Carl Foley, who had a company called Foley's Low Vision Aids. And old Carl Foley was demonstrating and talking Apple II computer. And I went through the roof. I was just totally blown away by that. And I had to have one. And I got my hands on one. And it completely turned my life around. It ruined my social life for a long time. And it got me out of college. I was kind of floundering around at university and was getting kind of C's and D's on my work. I was not willing to go through the extra mile that it took. As a blind student, I knew there had to be a better way, and I am, if nothing else, lazy. So the talking Apple computer really got me hooked, and I went from there to an IBM PC with I paid $3,000 for an IBM PC XT with a 10-megabyte hard drive and one 5 1/4 floppy and a whopping 640K of memory. And that's kind of how I got started.
So that would have been in the 1980s, what, the early 80s with the Apple II?
Early 80s, and as a result, I'm a great believer in being at the right place at the right time, and I've had a lot of good friends and a lot of good people around me who have, shall we say, kicked me in the fanny. And one of the things that was influential for me was a friend of mine was an editor at Byte Magazine and came over one day to visit my girlfriend. My wife, Cindy, keeps coming back into this. She is really the secret mastermind of all that's gone on in my life.
Yeah, it's often the way, yeah.
All for the good.
Yes.
Well, women civilize us.
Right.
My wife hasn't quite done that yet, but she's working on it.
Yeah, some of us are beyond redemption.
The friend of a friend was, as I said, was an editor at Byte, and she was a sorority sister of my wife, and she saw my Apple computer and was blown away by it, and said, well, why don't you send a letter to this guy named Bruce, who is an editor at the magazine? So I did that, and I thought I was going to make a sale to the magazine. Well, he rejected my idea. He said, well, this is way much too narrow. We don't really want to hear about, you know, your experience as a blind person with a talking computer, but how would you like to do a comparison of several different speech devices? So my first reaction was, I don't know a single thing about these other speech devices. All I knew was the Echo. And he said, well, but I didn't say that to him, obviously. So I said, oh, I'll be happy to do that. He said, fine, I'll cut you a check, and you have a 1 month is your deadline.
Hmm.
I hung up the phone, and I jumped up and down, and then I was scared to death. Because now I had to do something. I had to put my money where my mouth was, and I had to actually write something and finish something and do it in a professional manner. Well, I was a little manic. I spent an entire month writing that article, and I uploaded it on the last day it was due, the last minute it was due, and I bit my fingernails down to the bone, wondering, you know, are they going to accept this? Are they going to like it? And that was my first professional sale. That went into the magazine in the 1984 issue under the title The Search for Speech. And suddenly, once that article was published, I was getting letters from people. They were interested in, you know, how could I set up a talking computer? And so I started consulting up here in the Boston area. I was on SSI at the time, and I was making more... you know, more money then than I knew existed. I was really amazed that Cindy marched me out to the clothing shop and the new suit and business cards and stationery. And she, again, more civilizing. And, you know, I went from there to continue to write and to continue, you know, to do the technology. And in real Molson Stand, kind of at the right place at the right time. I was always a technology person to begin with. I was always kind of the science nerd, if you will. You know, the type of reading science fiction, taking things apart, putting them back together, science experiments, telescopes, chemistry sets. Fortunately, I didn't blow off any of my limbs when I was doing that. So I was a geek.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating to go back and look at some of those old computer publications now, isn't it? It's like reading a history of the way technology has evolved. And if you take some of those Byte issues from 1984, it just reminds you how far that we've come.
We really have. Really, really have. A sighted friend of mine was leafing through the magazine just the other day. He was like, oh my God, the Osborne computer, the Altair computer. Leading edge computer.
Yes.
You know, where have all these companies gone? And they really helped build this whole business up to where it is today.
Yeah, so did you use Braille Edit, you know, some of those raised dot computing products in the 80s?
I actually did. I did use Braille Edit. I actually wrote a manual that never saw the light of day called Braille Edit for Echo 2 Users, which was a manual just for people using speech who didn't have Braille. I was also at the time writing for a magazine called Insider, a little pun on the Apple terminology, writing product reviews and feature articles on everything from, you know, Apple-based voice recognition systems to anything to do with speech on the Apple platform.
Yeah, it was interesting the way that Apple kind of lost that race. You would have thought that with so many blind people using the Apple IIe's in those days, that the natural progression would have been to keep going up to the GS. I think some people did go for a GS, but then when the Macs came out, that seemed to be the end of it.
Yeah, I bought a GS. I have three feet to my left. I have a working Apple IIe. With an Echo.
Gosh.
Right here, sitting beside me. I turn it on every now and then just to hear it. And I've got some old, probably 15 or 20 old Apple discs with Apple games on them. So it's quite a blast from the past. I have an Apple IIc that I've kept in good shape. And I have an old IBM floppy, a two floppy drive PC, sitting around. I've got some old equipment here. I'm actually thinking of starting a kind of a mini computer museum.
Yeah, you should do that.
One of these days. A friend of mine has one of the old Kurzweil machines, which I may take off his hands. My wife is threatening to leave me if I bring it into the house.
I was wondering where it all goes, you know, where you've got room for all this stuff. But the 2GS made some good sounds. It had some of the best music of its day.
Yes. Well, I think the reason why, you know, that never really went where never went anywhere is because the business world went to IBM, and we kind of had to go in that direction to follow. I remember when I started working, I've been working for the Commission for the Blind in Boston, about 1987, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. I was going to bring my Apple II into work to automate the program because everything was on paper. And my boss was very savvy. He said, do whatever you need to do, but we are an IBM shop. You're not bringing that Apple computer anywhere near this building. So I used a deck. I had a deck talk on my computer with SoftVert.
Oh, yes. Bottom of text.
It's all text. And yeah. I used DBase 3.
Yeah.
And my boss, actually, he and I learned DBase programming together. We were the best in our agency to really, glom onto computers. This is our director of vocational rehabilitation, Mike Jakovsky. And this is at the time when Charlie Crawford was commissioner, so he was really behind technology. So, again, I was at the right place at the right time. I was, I had started to work in an agency that was just beginning to realize the benefits of technology, and here I was, the geek. Who dripped technology. When people went to my house, they saw my Apple computer, my IBM computer. They saw me doing stupid things like playing Lunar Lander on my Apple II using voice recognition board and teaching it to recognize the voice of my IBM PC. Total time-wasting stuff like that, but apparently that impressed other people.
Good game. The Oregon Trail was another one that I used to play a lot.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Kidnapped, Stonyville Manor. I'm really showing my age here. I wonder if anybody is actually even interested in this. I mean, we've just, gotten rid of everybody who was tuned in is now gone.
Well, that's all right. You and I can keep going. You know, you guys ran a pretty groovy bulletin board system at the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind. I used to ring that.
So that was all Charlie Crawford. I mean, that was a... Yeah. That was a pretty big system. That was definitely in the heyday of bulletin boards. That system is no longer with us. We have a website now that is a little more homogenized, if you will. Not quite as much material as was on the BBS, but times change.
Yeah, it ran PDF.
Yep.
Yeah. There you go. But you continue to write on technology-related subjects, and you eventually got to the point where you have published a number of books about not just blindness technology, but access technology in general.
Right. As I said, my first professional sale was in 1984 to Byte Magazine with The Search for Speech, and that was actually a product review. After that, I started writing articles, which are very different from reviews, but I got it in my head to do a book. I had always wanted to write. One of my dreams, actually, was to be a science fiction writer. I grew up reading science fiction, you know, Isaac Asimov and Robert Heinlein and Jerry Purnell, and actually got to meet a number of these chaps because I've been fortunate enough to publish a couple of stories in science fiction in Analog, and I'm certainly not a big name in science fiction. I consider myself the Bob Uecker of science fiction, kind of the low man on the totem pole, but it's gotten me, it has gotten me so many interesting friends I'm very, very grateful for that. I got it in my head to write a book on assistive technology, and I knew that if I wrote a book on just blindness technology, that would have a much more limited market.
Let me get you to just hold that thought for a second, because we've got a call who's probably calling long distance, so I should let them speak. Hello there, you're speaking with Joe Lazaro, 717.
Hello?
Yeah, this here is Danny.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing? Where are you calling from?
Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
Oh, right. Okay. You're not too far away. I'm in Boston, Mass., though.
That's a ways on up.
Not that far. Not as far away as this guy Jonathan is.
That's right.
I know.
I'm further away than you guys.
I'll tell you one thing. I was wondering, you know, I think it's amazing. I've never used a Macintosh, nor did I use an Apple, because unfortunately, back when I was going to college, I did not know that I could make an Apple computer talk.
Right.
And my parents got an Apple, and I didn't know it could talk, or I would have gone into computers a long time ago. I first got in them in the DOS days in about 88 or so.
Right.
But one thing I want to know, is there any hope? You know, I think Macintosh, the only screen reader that I've ever heard of is Outspoken.
Correct.
And people tell me that theoretically that should have been the computer of choice, because every program opens the same way, closes the same way.
It did.
The whole ball of wax.
That used to be very true. I used a Macintosh probably about eight years ago. And I used it a lot. I had a friend who was a Macintosh fanatic, who spent a lot of time with me, a guy by the name of Joe McManus, who showed me how to use the Mac.
Uh-huh.
And I'll tell you, the Mac was very accessible.
Mm.
It was a pleasure to use. Outspoken was very simple, and, you know, you could go to all the menus, you could cruise around the directories, you could launch programs, and it really was really a joy.
My.
And then it just all went to hell. And, I mean, now the Mac is probably, I would say, I don't want to say it's totally inaccessible, but I don't recommend it to people. It's kind of a shame.
In other words, even if you use System 9 and Outspoken, Mac is nowhere near accessible.
You can use it. I don't want
to
bash it. You can use it, but I think there's much more accessibility, ironically, on the Windows platform.
Well, you know what I'm really waiting for? Are you ready for this?
Yes.
I've used command line Linux without spoken before, but I'm waiting for a talking X Windows.
Well, there is a screen reader for X Windows. It's made by Beam Ltd. in the UK.
Uh-huh.
And I have not used it. There's also a screen reader for Linux, I'm sure you know, called SpeakUp.
That's what I'm talking about. That's in the command line.
Yeah, that's a lot of people are using that. That's very powerful. And I believe the NSA has a very secure version of Linux that will also speak as well with that. So I'm a Linux user. I have a shell account on a Unix system.
Uh-huh.
And I know probably a handful of Linux commands. I've never set up a Linux system, but I'm about to. And I just had an opportunity to write a white paper for Sun Microsystems on their new desktop environment called GNOME. Which has a lot of accessibility built in. It's not quite ready for prime time yet, but if you go to developer.gnome, which is GNOME.org, You can check that all out. They're building a screen reader for it, and a large print program, an on-screen keyboard, and it has a lot of accessibility hooks built right into it that will let developers create accessible applications and also create screen readers that don't break every time they change versions.
See, I'm wondering if this one in the UK could work with GNOME.
I don't know. It's from Beam LTD. If you want to send Jonathan, can I give my email address?
Absolutely.
I better write it down. Let me get over here.
If
I'm on a mobile.
Clickety-click.
All right.
Look at that.
Okay, I'm going to open up my notepad.
Yep. I hope you've assigned it to a hotkey.
Here I go.
Makes it much easier.
Okay.
Okay. Go to, my email is Lazzaro, L-A-Z-Z-A-R-O, @ theworld.com.
All right, say that again. Hold on, I missed all that.
Okay, one more time. It's Lazzaro, L-A-Z-Z-A-R-O.
L-A-Z-A?
No, two Z's. L-A-Z-Z-A-R-O, @ theworld.com.
At
and if not, I'm sure Jonathan can give that to people after the show if people haven't got it.
Excellent.
At world.com.
Correct.
Yep.
Lazzaro @ theworld.com.
Oh, theworld.com.
Theworld.com,
okay.
That's it.
Thank you.
Okay, have a good
I'll
night.
You
appreciate you calling in. You were just, what do you think of this? I'll come back to your book in just a second, obviously, your book writing career. But what do you think of this Linux thing? I mean, I've got to say, it really makes me quite amazed that with all the amazing access we have to Windows these days, which in my view, as a veteran of, like you, of the Apple and the DOS days, there's so much more consistency now, so much more power. It amazes me that there's such a fetish for Linux in the blind community.
I think the reason why people in the blind community are so interested in Linux is, and I'm probably going to piss people off by saying this, I think it reminds them of the days of DOS.
Right.
It's command line, it's very speech friendly, and I'll tell you, I mean, you know, people look at me and say, oh, I'm this big guru of technology. It took me 2 or 3 years to really get my brain around Windows. You know, I mean, I was in the same boat with everybody else, and, you know, my journey into Windows was not an easy one. And, you know, I think people there is still a lot of fear, believe it or not, in the blind community among people who are not using Windows yet. And I think Linux gives them a chance to use something familiar.
I wonder what it is about people that makes them either afraid to adapt to Windows or who find it slow to adapt to Windows, and those people who find it really intuitive. I guess I have to say I fall into that latter category. To me, Windows has always been absolutely glaringly obvious.
Were you a DOS user?
Yes. Oh, yes. I go back, like you, to the Apple IIe's.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I don't know either. I mean, I think that some people were thrown by Windows because it was presented to us as a visual system.
Right.
And if you don't have a good teacher teaching you Windows, if you have a sighted person trying to teach you Windows as a sighted person, trying to tell you things like, well, one window is open over here and another window is overlapping over here, and that really doesn't matter. What matters is that I've got 5 programs loaded and I can flip between them with this key, Alt-Tab, and go between them. Not where they are on screen, not how it looks.
Yes,
but
yes.
All the programs are set. I wrote a paper for for the American Foundation, on their Access World newsletter, and it was basically how to use Windows kind of from a minimalist point of view. And one of the things that I stressed in the paper was you use the control escape key to go to the start menu, and that's your main menu, that's your focus. You launch programs and documents from there. Once they're launched, you can flip between them with Alt-Tab. Each program has the same structure, the same basic commands. So once you've learned one program, you've learned them all. And I've tried to expand on this and tried to teach people this when I'm showing them Windows. And I think the best way to show people Windows or a good way to show them Windows is not to show them too much too soon and not to show them any spatial information, at least at the beginning, because it's not important. And I know there will be people who would disagree with that, but I found that to be successful.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think what used to hang up a lot of DOS users who were trying to switch to Windows was that a DOS user would be quite aware of the 25 rows and 80 columns, and so when they switched to Windows, they wanted to know what the screen looked like, where everything was, and as you say, you know, who actually cares? It doesn't matter.
Right, but I think the first approach, that I remember, you know, people who were programmers, you know, Windows programmers trying to show me Windows as a blind person. And we would sit there for hours with him describing, you know, there's a window here, it's 2 inches by 4 inches, and it's overlapped. And I would just bang my head against the wall. I don't understand this. I'm never going to comprehend it. Until I got to the point where I realized none of this really matters. Where it all is, I want to be able to flip between one program and I want to load, save, and print.
Yep.
And you know, using the keyboard, you can do all that.
And I guess, like me, you would have been one of the early, if not adopters, at least inquiring minds who examined Slimware Window Bridge when it came out in 1992.
And I got in trouble as I wrote a review of it, and I praised it for what it was, and I got a little bit of attacks. Because people thought I was too soft on it, that I was giving it more credit than it was worth. But I was pleased just to see somebody finally did it. And, you know, we had heard, how many years did we hear, oh, Windows will never talk, it will never be accessible because
it's right.
All pixels.
Yeah. We thought, as blind computer users, that we were about to be relics to the era of the dinosaur, you know, and for people who are now using Windows every day in their jobs, who weren't around then, it's hard to explain the fear that we had, that we'd have this golden era of computer access, and then all of a sudden it was going to be taken away. So Slimware Window Bridge was one heck of a breakthrough.
Yes. And, you know, was it perfect? Did it work for everything? No. But the fact that it worked at all was, I knew what was going to happen. If Slimware Window Bridge didn't work, the GW Micro would come out with a screen reader or a header joist, and they did.
And it was interesting to follow that conceptual journey, because I think in the early days of Window Bridge, there was a lot of fixation with what the screen looked like and things, and then gradually, as they got more feedback from blind people who were using it, they moved away from that, and so really blind people themselves shaped their own interface to Windows over time.
Right. And it took us a long time to get to the point we're at now. Jim Thatcher from IBM, the guy who was one of the OS2 screen reader developers, he was a big help to me. He was someone who you know, is a real strong friend of the blind. He's got a website, jimthatcher.com.
Yep.
It's one of the best courses on web accessibility I've ever seen in my life.
Yes.
Really comprehensive, and it's free. Go up there, go to jimthatcher.com and check it out. We had to learn how to learn Windows. You know, and that was a major thing to learn.
And, you know, his screen reader, too, for OS2 was a very impressive product, and it's just a shame that OS2 went west, really, because it was a great piece of software.
Yeah, it was. It was. And, you know, he's a brilliant guy, and he's continuing to work in this field. So.
Yeah.
He was also, I think, one of the co-developers on the IBM web browser.
Yeah, homepage reader, yeah. Yeah, well, we've had him on the program, so you're in good company.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, there you go.
He is a true genius.
Yeah.
I am just a tinkerer.
Well, now, let's get back to you were saying that you were looking at writing a book, but that you were aware that if you were just going to write on blind-specific things, that was quite a narrow kind of market.
Right. I wanted to write something that would have a much wider audience. And I knew that in a book, I wasn't going to be able to cover every field in depth. I wasn't going to cover blindness in depth or deaf technology or technology for people with other types of disabilities in depth. But so I focused on how to adapt personal computers. And I didn't get into wheelchairs or ramps or any of that other kind of technology. So I confined myself specifically to PC access. So that first book was published in 1993. The title was Adaptive Technologies for Learning and Work Environments, which is the world's longest and most horrible. And I was rereading parts of that book just the other day, and it was like, oh my God. This is in the days of the 386 computer with 33 megahertz processors. And I think there was a line in there about how blindingly fast computers were now.
And you'd have a whopping
4 to 8 megabytes of RAM.
That's right. Well, even, I mean, if in 1993, if you had a meg of RAM, you were doing pretty well.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, this stuff just changes. So I have a new addition to that book now, Adaptive Technologies for Learning and Work, which was just published last year. And I didn't want to repeat the mistakes of the first book and mention and put things in it that would be obsolete. So rather than quote specific numbers for things, I took what I would call a systems requirements approach. So rather than telling people, well, you need 8 megabytes of memory to do this, I thought it was more valuable to teach people, go and figure out what system requirements are all about. So when you buy a piece of software, you're going to need to know how much memory does my computer have, how much disk space does my computer have, and how much of that do I need to run the software. Do I have a fast enough processor? Do I have enough memory? Do I have enough disk space? Do I have a sound card? So that was the approach I took with the new book. That book mentions about 250 products. It is available in print and also available in CD-ROM. And it's the CD-ROM version is all standard HTML.
And what's your target audience? Who do you feel you're targeting with this book?
People with disabilities, educators, librarians, human resource people, allied health professionals. Let me shut that off.
Wow, that was scary.
That was a blast. Well, that's my cordless phone.
Oh.
Basically, any person who relates to someone with a disability, teachers, librarians, human resource people, managers, almost anyone.
Right. Now, Microsoft have just published a similar kind of book promoting accessible technology. Have you seen that?
I have not seen the book. I've seen write-ups of it, but I have not read it.
Yeah. It sounds very similar, although I think having someone who uses the technology writing as you have done will probably give it a different kind of flavor, different emphasis. I mean, clearly Microsoft's got a Microsoft emphasis on their stuff.
Well, in my book, and I'm going to switch phones on you if that's all right.
That's all right.
Are you there?
Yes, it was safely accomplished. Look at that.
There we go. That's a little bit. I was on a cordless phone, which I think was dying.
Oh, dear.
In my book, I mentioned I didn't want to confine myself specifically to Windows. So I do mention Macintosh, and I do mention Linux platforms in my book. I mentioned about 250 specific hardware and software products for all different types of disabilities. What I try to do is give people in the book an idea of how... Well, I start off basically by telling them what's inside a computer. Now, I really feel that the more you know about what's inside the box, the better you are. What's the hard drive? What's memory? What's the difference between that? How do the bits and pieces inside a computer work, and what do they do? And so we go on from there to talk about operating systems and what an operating system is, what an application is, how to run the computer from the keyboard, the accessibility utilities found on Windows, Macintosh, Linux, and then I go into the specific product groups for each disability. I talk about web access, about accessibility to software. I talk about setting up an infrastructure for adaptive technology if you're, say, a college or a university. And then I give some funding resources. It's about a 220-page book.
Excellent. You've also been involved in web accessibility issues.
Well, yes, I do advise on that because of my position at the commission.
Hmm. I'd like to seek your opinion about the difference in emphasis that appears to be there with respect to the 508 standards and the W3C guidelines. It seems to me that the W3C is really emphasizing universal design. In other words, no matter how old your browser is, that this page will work if you follow the guidelines, whereas 508 appears to be saying you need to make the page accessible with, you know, reasonably current technology, which is quite a different thing.
Well, I'll tell you, it isn't always possible to do that because not everyone has the latest technology. So when you're trying to make something accessible, you don't want to slam the door on people who are using things like links, for example.
Yeah, but why should the web be constrained by people who are using such antiquated technology?
Well, it should and it shouldn't. I mean, obviously, there has to be a cutoff point for that. There has to be a time when we say, okay, we're not going to support this anymore. And I believe that's a gray area. I'm not quite sure where we should go with that. We certainly don't want to cut people off. But I'll tell you, here in the United States, right now I have a high-speed internet. I have a cable modem, and that is not the situation everywhere in the world.
Sure.
You know, and we live in fairly technologically advanced countries, and we forget that other people don't have access to what we do.
That's
so
true.
I think the answer is to raise the bar and to get people high-speed access.
I mean, another example is that it seems that at least I don't go to W3C too regularly because it makes my heart increase and it's not good for me. But, when I last looked, they were talking about tables and avoid using frames. Now, when you look at the latest screen readers, and it's even going to be more so the case when you look at JAWS 4.5, which has the most incredible interaction with the HTML I've ever seen. And to be fair, homepage readers had it for ages, that actually having material presented in tables and dividing the page up into frames is hugely helpful. And yet here you have the W3C telling people not to do something that helps us.
Well, sometimes the guidelines don't keep up with the technology that's on the ground.
And that's my point, you see, that these guidelines are trying to confine the web to a sort of a links-based time warp.
Yeah, there is some of that going on. I hear that. I hear people that still say we should revitalize DOS. We're not going to go back. I mean, that we know how technology works. We don't go back. We certainly don't want to abandon people, but we really should encourage them to move into the newer technologies.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it depends on where one places one's emphasis on some kind of lobbying campaign to say, well, actually, blindness is predominantly an information handicap, and to overcome those information handicaps, you've got to have access to the technology, rather than saying, we're going to try and constrain the development of this technology because we're going to leave people out in the cold. It seems to me that that you can't, as Bill Gates would say, not that I'm fond of quoting him, but you can't stifle innovation.
No, nor should you. Nor should you stifle innovation, because, and again, I will admit my bias. I'm a person who grew up in a technologically advanced country, or so we think. My dad was an aircraft engineer making jet engines for General Electric. I grew up around technology. When I was in, I was the kid doing the science experiments in school, and I think technology is good. I think it is always a way to make our lives better. You know, can we use technology for evil? Certainly. I can go downstairs and pull a knife out of a drawer and wreak mayhem. But I can also use that to slice up a nice pork roast.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and make dinner. So it really is. Technology is not good or evil. It really is in the hands of the wielder.
When I talk to people about the W3C guidelines, many people whose opinions I really respect make the same point that you did, that perhaps the guidelines are not keeping up. Why isn't anything actually done about that, though? I mean, why do they remain antiquated?
I'm not sure of that. I'm not on the W3C, and I don't... I'm certainly not on the inside of that development, and they are the definitive set of guidelines as far as the accessibility community is concerned. And the 508 guidelines seem to be offering a little bit of competition to that. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the 508, as I understand it, has obviously some legislative authority, whereas W3C is simply guidelines, and I guess there is actually nothing to stop a new consortium from coming up with more realistic guidelines.
Well, my one complaint about the W3 guidelines, with all due respect, is they are very, very technical and very, very arcane.
Mm.
I'm a technical person, and I find going through those guidelines very difficult. I understand that you have to be precise when you're describing technology, or you're describing something to do with science and technology. But the whole purpose of these guidelines, in my opinion, is to get them into the hands of people who will use them. And if they're impenetrable, then how good of a service are we really doing? I'm sure I'm going to get in trouble for that.
Oh, well, that's good. We like a bit of controversy. Look, I'll tell you what, I'd even go this far, and you may think I'm being oversimplistic. If we could just emphasize to all web developers one thing, which is put alt text on your graphics, probably about 95% of our web access problems would go away overnight.
A lot of them would.
And,
an awful lot of them would.
You don't get those very clear, simple messages unless you go to... unless you go elsewhere.
Well, it is ironic that one of the guidelines, according to the W3, is use clear, concise language. And this is not just my opinion, that the guidelines are impenetrable. And I yourself and other people, other professionals who I respect, have said the same thing. So, this is tough love. And, we love the W3C, but... a little bit. Maybe they need to hire a writer.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Now, before we go on to the bionic eye matter, which is going to take, I think, probably the remainder of our interview, I just wanted to ask you about your take on appliances. I've been reading some articles recently, and I guess like you would do, I skim a lot of information technology journals in my work. There is more and more functionality creeping into things like cell phones. So much going on with text messaging. Appliances are becoming more and more difficult to even cook a meal or watch the TV channel you want. And we don't seem to be making any progress whatsoever in those areas of making appliances accessible.
That's very true. That is very true. One of the big problems I have here at home is I have television, VCR, DVD, cable TV, and I have three or four different remote controls. And I actually, on the third floor of my house, I have my office. And I keep that room locked, so no one will go up there and mess around with my remote controls on my television. Because if somebody screws it up, I have to call my wife, and say, "Honey, it doesn't work. Help." Mm. And, it's maddening because it's something very simple. It doesn't have to be this way. I'm exploring using a computer to do that, to perform the functions of a remote control, using X10 and other types of technology. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there are a handful of accessible appliances, talking microwave, VCR, things like that. There might be some, as these devices become more computer-like or more peripheral-like, we may see
we may see things that will let us use our common access technology to use. This is not a subject that I have a lot of knowledge in or kitchen appliances, but I would think the way to go would be to have computer compatible appliances that can report their status to a home network.
Yeah.
And then control the devices that way.
I have seen that working. I have friends who've got their whole house functioning with X10, and things happen, you know. The volume turns up to a predetermined level, and the right TV channel comes on at 6 o'clock for their chosen news bulletin, and all sorts of amazing stuff. But it's not for the faint of heart, of course.
No, and it's not inexpensive.
No.
It's very expensive.
Yeah. And it's not as if we haven't a solution for this. When you talk to the people at the Trace Research Center, for instance, years and years ago they came up with a solution, this kind of device that would plug into a serial port, say of you, you know, they were talking about the Braille Speak or the Braille Light in those days, and there are other similar devices now, that would send common signals, and all your devices would understand these signals, and you'd be able to control them from your access device. But for whatever reason, there's been no traction with it, it seems to me anyway.
Right, and I don't know if that's because of an interest on the part of the blind community, because we're getting by with what we have. Maybe what it will take is a smart company like a GW Micro or Freedom Scientific to start doing this.
Because we're not getting by, really, are we? I mean, even just the last weekend, you have a situation, for example, we've got three children, and if my wife goes out and my four-year-old, who can't really read too well yet, wants a DVD put on, I can put the DVD in the machine, but of course then you've got a menu where the option to play the movie is inaccessible and could be in a different place depending on the menu of the movie that you're in, and there's just not a whole bunch of anything you can do about that.
No, there really isn't. I know that WGBH here in Boston has made some accessible DVDs, but these are very few and far between.
Mm.
One would think that Hollywood, with all of its money and all of its political correctness, would glom onto this.
And there's space on the disc for it. You know, you've got 6 gigs to play with on a DVD.
Yeah, what DVDs now are very complex. They have menus that come up with, you know, choose this, you know, the director's cut or the extended play or, you know, the French version.
So
they're very, very problematic.
Yeah, I managed to get Yellow Submarine on for my son in Italian once.
Yes, there. I'm sure that made him quite pissed off.
He enjoyed it, actually. He's a very, very, very liberal young man. Do you think that the answer to this problem is greater advocacy to the producers of this stuff, or are we such a small market that the only way we can achieve the kind of result we're looking for is legislation, do you think?
I think both of those are correct. I think that it is not difficult for a manufacturer to build accessibility into a device as long as they do it from the ground up, as long as they do it from the beginning. It would be very, very easy to make a device such as you've described that would have, say, a VCR with a USB port on it.
Yeah.
You know? And if you can do that, then you can make a device that can not only work for the blind, but work for the sighted as well. So you have to be really successful with any kind of technology, you've got to make it the mass market.
Well, it seems to me from this distance that 508 really is making an appreciable difference in a number of areas. You look at the number of companies who have jumped on the accessibility bandwagon post-508.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have come a long way. I will grant you that. We really, really have come a long way. There's still a lot more things to be done, things like appliances, things like AOL, America Online, is still not fully up to snuff yet. And it's not like we haven't been beating, you know, people over the head with this for years. There's a lot of inertia against accessibility.
Why is that?
I think most companies are afraid it will cost them money. And we're really not that important. I'm a great believer in the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And if you look back at the black community, why were they so successful at getting civil rights and equality, which is a basic human right? Why did they get their civil rights? Because they raised one hell of a fuss. We don't do that. We don't sue people. We don't chain ourselves to buildings. You know, we don't have protests. And very often our organizations sell us out because they say things like, well, the blind don't need detectable warnings because that will make people think we're stupid. You know? So, I don't know. I mean, I'm a fairly cynical guy, and I'm beginning to realize that a lot of things boil down to the almighty dollar. So, it very often, we often don't do the right thing. We do the thing that makes us money. We do the thing that lines our pocket. And I'm not saying that I'm a saint, but there comes a time when you just have to do the right thing.
I know that, you know, I still give Microsoft a hard time when they come on any of my programs because there are pockets of Microsoft applications that are still painful to use. But they have come one heck of a long way in the last 5 or 6 years. I mean,
they really have.
Yeah, you will recall the hassle that we had trying to get Internet Explorer 4 to work. I mean, it came out. We had a completely accessible 3.02, and then it came out and it was broke. And, you know, they just would not do that anymore, I don't think, anyway. Hey, why do you think we sort of cracked it with Microsoft? What was the secret there? I mean, we didn't go and chain ourselves to their buildings either.
Well, yes, we did, sort of. I'll never forget one of the things we did in Massachusetts was we threatened to boycott Microsoft products. And once we did that, about 8 other states went in with us, and they thought they were going to lose money.
Okay.
And we made a case to our state government that you are violating federal and state law by buying Windows because it's inaccessible. And they sent out a vice president to meet with us immediately. So I think we have done that. We, you know, we shook them up. And, you know, and I also think that there were good people inside of Microsoft waiting to be unleashed. People like Greg Lowney, who worked there and still works there, who believed in what we believed in but had no power.
Yeah, it was often hard for some of those guys who we knew were going in giving the other Microsoft guys a hard time, but of course had to toe the company line publicly. And unfortunately, guys like Greg got a lot of the flack, whereas in fact they were very good advocates inside.
Yes, they were. And Greg is a good friend of mine, somebody who I think has done a lot for us behind the scenes and has gotten almost, you know, gotten very little credit for it.
There you go. Well, this is fascinating. Now, I want to bring you around. Let me talk to you about the bionic vision, which was something that we promoted when we mentioned that we were going to be talking to you. And I sort of want to ask you, I want to go straight to the chase with this. So you seem to me to be a very successful, at least on the surface, well-adjusted blind individual. Why?
I'm actually quite mad.
Yeah, well, why would you want this to have some sort of vision restored?
Why would I want to? Okay, well, I'm 45 years old. Matter of fact, my birthday is tomorrow, August 5th.
Well, happy birthday.
Send your cards and letters and folders.
Well, because it's August 5th here, you know. It's your birthday in New Zealand.
It is.
Yeah.
It's my birthday there already.
Yeah, I can.
All right.
Yeah.
Why do I want this? I lost my sight when I was 15 years old. Okay, and my philosophy about blindness is pretty simple. I am not ashamed of being blind. I am not proud of my blindness as a thing. I don't think there's any pride in a disability per se. I think the pride comes from how you deal with it. You know, that I've overcome it. I spat in its face. I did the best I could. I'm a writer. I'm a science fiction writer. I'm a husband. I own my own home. I have a nice job. I have friends. And, you know, I'm enjoying my life. If I can get back some vision, I think that is an improvement. Now, that, you know, that goes against the grain of the whole disability rights movement And many people in that movement tell me things like, I wouldn't, you know, get my sight back even if I could. And that's fine. I don't have a problem with that. I don't think we should hunt people down and force them to do anything they don't want to do. Am I hanging by a thread waiting for this to happen? No. If I can do it, I will certainly go for it. And because I believe, and whether this is politically correct to say so or not, human beings are better off if they have all their faculties. Now, that isn't to say that and again, I'll backtrack a little and backpedal, and I'm not going to say that being blind is something bad. It's not something bad. But are we not better off if we have good hearing and good vision and good mobility?
Tell me about what this technology can do at the moment, because when I was reading up on this in advance of this interview, there have been 8 patients who have had some vision restored through the Dobel Institute in Portugal that have implanted this, $70,000 a pop, and apparently some people are even doing some driving in limited situations.
Very limited. Oh, let me tell you, this system is very crude. It's very primitive. It provides you with a field of view 14 by 24 inches held at arm's length. So imagine taking something like an album, like an old LP to a record album, the kind that opened up,
yep,
and hold that at arm's length. That's the window that you're looking through. Now, in that window, what you're seeing are dots of light that make up shapes of objects that you see. So if you look with this device at, say, a broom handle leaning against the wall, you will see a string of vertical dots of light comprising the broom handle.
So would you be able to read?
The dot background.
And could you read, yeah, if there was something on the broom handle, you know, like Nimbus 2000 or something, would you be able
to... Not at the present time. This system, again, is very, very low resolution. I believe it's about 500 pixels. That could be wrong. It is nowhere near normal vision in terms of resolution or depth or sharpness. However, because this system is photoelectric, in that it basically mimics what the human eye does. It receives light with a camera. It translates that light into electrical signals, which are fed to a computer, and those signals are then fed into both hemispheres of your visual cortex. So this system plugs directly into the brain, and I think this system has tremendous potential for advancement because, again, it is a photoelectric device, and it will work on people no matter what their visual condition is, as long as they were not blinded as infants or blinded in very, very early childhood. In other words, you must have a working visual cortex in order for this to function.
And is there anything external that you have to wear, or is it all inside your head?
No, it has a camera, a small camera, which is mounted on a pair of glasses.
Okay.
The camera is about an inch long and an inch in diameter. And then there is a small computer about the size of a dictionary that you wear on your belt, that you can wear on a backpack. So it is, again, I don't want to misrepresent what this is. This is not a system that we will plug in and suddenly you'll have 20/20 vision, and you jump off the operating table and say, okay, I'm glad that's over with now. You need to be trained to use this. However, the first phonograph records were scratchy and crude. You could barely hear them. And they were on cylinders. Then we had the 78, and then we had LPs and cassettes and CDs, and now we do digital. I have no doubt that this system will advance if it is permitted to do so. you know, just as you mentioned earlier, the Trace Center had a very good idea, and it's gone nowhere. That could happen with this. I think there's a lot of inertia, excuse me, in the current system. There's a lot of money being made on behalf of the blind. What will happen to these institutions if the blind population is in danger of decline? What happens if this has the potential to eradicate the blindness in 10 or 20 years?
So because it's got a computer that's external, presumably as they improve the technology, they can do software upgrades on it and improve the vision.
Oh, yes.
It's
a very simple procedure.
Okay. What do you expect to be able to do then, I mean, functionally speaking, as a result of this?
That's a good question. What this will allow me to do is to go from being a nearly totally blind person, I have just light perception, to someone who can see objects in the environment visually. I won't have to feel for objects or explore the environment. I will be able to scan and see them. Now, again, I'm really, really being very careful here. I don't want to oversell this system, and I don't want to give people false expectations. I'll give you an example. Let's say I was walking down the street, and I see an object in front of me, a square object, in my field of view. I'll have no idea what it is. Is it a mailbox? Is it a cardboard box? Is it maybe a sign? What is this object? But the important fact is that I will see the object. Now, one of the patients who I spoke to, a gentleman named Jens, who is a Canadian farmer, told me, and he told CNN, he was sitting at a table, seated at a table, and on the table was an object, a square object. He could see it. He didn't know what it was, but he knew exactly where it was and reached for it and said, oh, that's a remote control for a television. The important fact is that he was able to see where it was. He didn't have to feel across the table for it. He reached right for it and took it.
Okay. Well, I should say, while I'm musing on this, we're speaking with Joe Lazzaro, and if you would like to speak with him, you can give us a call. Our number is area code 212-812-2800, and you should find that in the title bar of the program if you're listening live. Area code 212-812-2800, and then, courtesy of spiderphone.com, punch in the conference code to get in, 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. Have you ever seen a movie called At First Sight?
No.
Okay. This guy, I think he had a little bit of vision as a child, but he gradually went completely blind, and I believe it was based on a true story. He eventually got an operation that restored his sight, but he didn't have any visual memory, and so he ended up finding the whole experience a terribly horrifying one, because he was suddenly getting all this input that he couldn't translate.
Well, that is very valid. Michael May, the gentleman who...
From Sendero Group.
Yep. Is going through some of that now. Again, I'm not advocating this for any other person. I think it's a good thing. I have submitted my application to the Dobell Institute because, as you said earlier, I'm an early adopter, and this is, to me, kind of the ultimate technological exploration. I've been told by them that I may be a candidate for the procedure sometime later this year or early next year, and I'll certainly let people know what happens with it from my point of view. I went through a lot of emotions when I heard about this. I was very excited and then very fearful. And I think, you know, other people are going to have the same kind of reaction to this. You know, people, when you give people hope that they might have some vision restored, it dredges up a lot of emotions and a lot of anxiety, and it makes people uncertain. Well, do I want to do this? What happens if I try it and it doesn't work? What happens if I try it and it does work? what will it change my life for the better, for the worse? Will I get anything out of it? One who was a candidate for this procedure decided not to have it done because he was afraid that would make him ordinary. He was a at the present time he's a blind attorney, very successful, and he said, "Well, if I get this device, then I'm going to be, you know, a sighted attorney. I'm not going to be unique anymore."
Hmm. Interesting.
You know, to which I say, "Well, you could always become a crossdresser."
Let's go and talk to area code 559. You're speaking with Joe Lazzaro.
Ah, this is a very interesting discussion, and I wonder if that blind attorney had any vision before, as you did, because I think that has a lot to do with it. By the way, my name is Dave McElroy. I live in Visalia, California.
Hello, Dave.
Hi. I'd like to ask you a question, and the reason I'm asking this question is because I myself have never seen, or at least not to my memory. I think I've had more light perception than I do now, but
okay.
Basically no.
Okay.
You made the statement that empirically it is better to have all senses than not. My simple yet amazingly complex question to you is, why?
Well, I will say this, and I don't expect this to be a popular opinion in the disability community. But I'm the type of person who I will always give you my honest opinion. The reason why I believe that is because human beings with motor functions, and it is in the best interest of individuals to have those.
If that were the case, then one would have to expect that whoever or whatever created us would have seen to that prior to the fact that most of us are born. I guess what concerns me and is that what is happening, and again, I think I'm reasonably open-minded about this. I like you, I'm kind of a cynical person. I think the almighty dollar has a lot to do with any of this, the technology. But it appears to me that we are stating, to use your statement, no, that it is empirically better, is to say that there is something wrong with those of us who are not fully availed of our senses. And as long as we have that mentality, I think we're always going to be on the back steps of technology and of the world at large.
I'm not saying that we are worthless as people.
You're not saying that, but
no.
Your statements imply that. I don't know what you can do to unimply that. I see what you want to say,
yeah.
And I hear what you're actually saying. And unfortunately, I believe you that your intention is not to say that there's something wrong.
No, I don't think there's anything wrong with me per se, but I do think that. And again, I'm speaking more from a quantitative kind of a scientific, like a cold detachment. A human being is more capable if they have all of their senses, and I mean that's a fact. And I don't, again, I don't expect that to be popular. And I don't, for example, let me give you just some of the things that I see. And I don't see you as a fanatic. I think you are.
No, I'm not. I'm not a fanatic.
I don't see you as somebody who's bashing me for my idea.
And I'm not.
No, I don't think you are. And I know. And I realize this thing is going to stir up a lot of emotions. It stirred up emotions with me. I mean, I'm in the same boat as everybody else is. There were these two women who had a child.
Yeah.
And they decided they wanted to have a deaf child. And they went so far as to get a sperm donor who had been deaf in his family for four generations, so they would increase the chances of having a deaf child. I think that is the epitome of selfishness. I don't have a problem with you. you know, going and poking your eyes out or your ears out or chopping off your hand.
Dick.
If you want to do that to yourself, that's fine. Go ahead and do it. But to do that to a child, and Bill Dobell was the CEO of the Dobell Institute was telling me that he was involved in a lawsuit he was involved with the cochlear implant for the deaf, which
right.
is kind of analogous to this. And a lawyer stood up in court and said, "I have a right to be deaf." There's a lot of doublespeak going on in the disability community, okay? And I think part of that has to do with we don't want to make people feel bad. We don't want to make people feel lesser. And I don't think we're any less. I'm not ashamed to be blind. I'm not less of a man. I'm not less of a human being. You know, I'm a pretty good guy. But I'm speaking strictly in a Darwinist kind of way, and, you know, that opens up another can of worms as well. I mean, if
especially in this country, old boy, out here in my day, you'd be out in the corner.
I'm out to dry. But, you know, so I'm speaking specifically, you know, about capabilities.
I think for myself, I mean, the one thing that I, you know, I really feel the pinch more than our technology is in transportation. I mean, I would if this would, and I'm not a very much. I admittedly am not a big risk taker. I wish I were. If you came to me and said, you know, the probability is that if this worked, you could drive. I might even consider it.
Right.
But I would not consider it for partial vision.
Right.
I cannot see how that would be.
I understand, and that's very valid, and one of the things I'm learning at the age of 45 is that people have other opinions besides my own. It took my wife a lot of years to beat that into my head. I understand that, and that is very valid. You are not going to get a lot of vision back from these
right.
types of devices
for
right
for myself,
time.
That
right.
would mostly that would remove any. I just don't have any curiosity.
If you have some vision at all, even
no.
You have more vision than this system will provide you. This is for somebody who is totally blind or nearly totally blind, and it will give them some limited, low resolution, low. Narrow field.
Okay, I've got to move it on because we've got a couple of calls backed up. But very good points, Dave. Thank you, and congratulations. Oh, Dave's
yeah.
gone. Dave's a granddad.
Really?
He's just had a little wee grandchild, and I was just about to congratulate him. Not that he did any of the work, but he needs congratulating just the same.
Oh, he did. Yes, he most certainly did.
Well, I suppose that's true.
A few years ago.
A long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
Far, far away.
Area code 631, you're speaking with Joe Lazzaro.
Good evening, Jonathan.
Hi there.
Very good show tonight.
Thank you.
This is Richard Costa, by the way, sir.
Oh.
I do, as a matter of fact, have... know someone who has already gone through the surgery, but he doesn't have the prosthetic device as well. He's 67 years old, and he's kind of going in with the Edison that he'll take when he can get. I believe he was recently blind from a some type of accident.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that he figures that it's like you, as far as his feeling is that, well, someone has to be a pioneer in doing this, but me personally, I just think the technology is just too primitive.
Oh, it is. It's extremely primitive right now.
To take the kind of risk of opening up one skull and having 64 electrodes implanting in, I mean, it's really not worth the risk.
I understand that, and I respect that. And, again, I don't think people should be rounded up and forced to undergo this. It should certainly be voluntary. To me, it's worth the risk. It's worth... I'm curious. I'm curious as all hell to see what I would see with this. Would I be able to use this for in my work? Would I be in some small way able to evangelize the technology, maybe bring, maybe show people what the technology is like, maybe help push that envelope a little bit. I mean, to me, if I could be involved with that even in a small way, that would warm the cockles of my heart tremendously. It would make up for some of the evil things I've done in my life in the past, like ruining my parents' tablecloth when I was a kid. You know, it's
a little extreme.
A little extreme. I'm being
facetious. Well, the other thing is too is that even after you get done with all this device, I mean, it's only one. After all, everything is all said and done. It's only really one eye. So it's like you don't even get any kind of.
No, it's both eyes.
Really?
It's both eyes.
The way I understood it is that it is just one camera and the
one,
other camera.
Yes, that is correct. It is one camera, but it feeds into both hemispheres of the brain, so it's bilateral.
Yeah, but you don't get. I thought I had heard is that, in other words, there's a range finder, a laser range finder, in order for. So you don't really get the benefit of depth perception.
It has very crude depth perception. You are absolutely right, and I'm not going to dispute that one iota. My point, you know, again, is that this is alpha. This is version 1.0. You know, remember Slimware Window Bridge where it was. Remember, you know, the first DOS screen reader. You know, remember the first photograph, the first plane, whatever. You know, the first time, you know, we went into space, they say you didn't ride the capsule, you wore it. And now we have a space plane, the space shuttle. We've been to the moon, and presumably we'll go beyond that. So, God willing and man willing, technology will advance.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I mean, I've heard about that that whole controversy. Was very interested about the cochlear implant.
Yeah,
and I think it's terrible to put parents and kids, because they were only trying to do, and let's face it, if you don't do something like that early on, you know, the kid doesn't get any benefit out of going through the surgery and the whole process. You know, it's like developing the visual cortex. I have that advantage as well. I mean, I never saw colors, but I have the visual cortex to where I could, you know, had fairly good vision to the point to where I could watch TV and all at one time.
Right.
Now I don't. So I understand that you know, you have to be able to have that visual process there to start with. You can't. I mean, it's not going
to
work.
Right. You have to have that part of the brain. One of the more interesting questions, or actually more important questions, they ask you on the application is: when you dream, do you see in your dreams?
Yeah, I do.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, then this would probably work for you. Do you see all the time in your dreams?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, I dream.
I do sometimes. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't.
And I know in school I daydream quite a bit. So, yeah, I have, I guess, a very imaginative imagination.
I think a big part of this is that sense of imagination. I've been blind for 30 years. To the point where I sometimes don't even bother visualizing things anymore. So
well, the thing
I
that's scary for me is that, I mean, I could, when I'm sitting in front of things or doing things, I mean, I can honestly say, I could swear that I see it, even though I know physically I can't actually, I don't have the ability to see, but I could swear that I actually see what's there and get more than just the sensation of being in the room.
Right.
Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. I appreciate you calling in.
And you take care, Jonathan, again. Good show.
Thanks, sir. See you later.
All right, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye now. We're speaking with Joe Lazzaro, and we'll go to this call, who is unknown according to the caller ID. Hello there.
Hi, Jonathan. It's Maureen.
Hi, Maureen.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I would be really interested in what a totally blind person, and I have some light perception, but I've never seen anything else, what a totally blind person would actually experience, and whether that part of the brain can actually be trained, because in other areas, like when someone had a stroke, they have to retrain
right.
whole sectors of the brain, and that is not impossible, I think.
No, I don't think so either. And I'm not a neurophysicist by any means, so I don't want to misspeak. But I'm a very strong believer in trying things. Okay, I mean it. Before we landed on the moon, one of the questions we were concerned about with is, will the spacecraft sink into the dust on the moon? Is the moon dust so deep that the spacecraft won't be able to land? It'll just get buried. It'll fall into quicksand. We had to try it. So that's kind of how I feel about this. We need to try it. Dobell thinks that people who are born blind won't be able to take advantage of this. He's not closing a door. I think we need to do more implants. We need to see how it works with people. I don't think he's done. He has one patient who was born blind in one eye, but that person had vision in his other eye, and it worked for him. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't want to oversell this. I don't want to, you know, I'm not on his payroll. I'm interested in this for the technology's sake, as a blind person and as someone who works in this field.
Right, and that's, I think, would be the right way to approach it. It's not because functionality at the moment is probably secondary still, but
yeah.
At some point.
I know I will get something out of this. If this works as advertised, even if I'm able, did you ever use the Opticon?
I myself haven't.
Yeah, I've used it a bit. Yeah, yeah.
This is kind of like a visual Opticon. You see the world as dots.
Okay.
Okay, it makes up images as dots. It's very crude, but I'll be happy to take it. I'll try it. Right now, if I look out of the corner of my eye, I could see light. That's about all I've got. I'll take this. I might even be happy with this.
Well, and I suppose in this case, all you would have to do if you didn't like it is just take the glasses off, right?
Just unplug it.
Right.
You know, and I could have it removed. I mean, it's not a, you know, presumably they won't stick a screwdriver into my brain and damage me. None of the people who have had this done have been damaged by the procedure. They've been doing it as a research project for 30 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it started in the late 1900s.
It'd really be very interesting. I'm a very non-visual or non-spatial person, not very spatially oriented. It would just be interesting to have the experience and to see if you could make sense of the world in that way or could learn to.
Well, there's also a technology out which is really kind of neat called Seeing with Sound.
Yeah.
I haven't heard of it.
You can go back and listen to a main menu show where we demonstrate that. In the archives.
That's kind of cool. That's basically a computer and a camera and stereo headphones. And the guy who developed it, I believe his name is Peter Meager. Meager. He seems like a very fairly brilliant chap. And I'm on his internet email list. And people are getting a lot of benefit from it. It's very simple. But very often the best things are the simplest.
I will look that up. Thank you very much, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, lovely to hear you, Maureen. Thanks for calling. Now, another example of that kind of technology, Joe, is the sonic guide type material that Professor Leslie Kay here in New Zealand, in fact, has produced.
Years ago, I used a device called the sonic guide. Is this the same device?
Yes, basically, yeah.
Okay.
And
I'm all for those kind of technologies. I think that those can be beneficial to people. Unfortunately, the mobility instructor community wanted no part of that.
Mm. Well, I was a guinea pig with that stuff when I was a kid. That's to a sonic headband where you sort of put this thing on around your head, and these little earpieces went into your ears, and eventually, I got so good at it that I could do, the whole slalom thing where you could walk around a field full of poles and avoid them all. It worked.
Sure. Yeah, I used the MOAT sensor.
Yes.
That was a great piece of technology. But again, mobility instructors wanted no part of it. And So, I mean, that makes me very angry when I see a technology that can help people and it gets ignored, either for politics or fear or whatever. It just burns me alive.
What about the seemingly incompatible divergent paths that this could take us down, where on the one hand you have blind people clamoring for our civil rights, and on the other you have people saying, forget about all this stuff, just work harder on a cure and eliminate the whole blind population?
Well, it's going to be a long time before we eliminate the blind population. Even if these technologies pan out, it's going to take, I believe, a couple of decades for that to happen. Now, one technology that's very interesting are the drugs they're coming up with now for macular degeneration.
Yes.
That actually have the ability to reverse blindness symptoms. There's the retina chip, which is also beginning to go through. There's a research project in the UK which wraps a coil around the optic nerve, and this coil communicates with a video camera in a wireless mode. NASA is developing a retina chip to replace the retina. And while this is all going on, stem cell research and other types of surgical techniques are being improved. I really do think we're getting very close to the beginning of the end of blindness with this, where, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it certainly is happening, and we're starting to see these technologies bear fruit. They're very small, and they're not very visible right now, but we're at the point where the dam is starting to break.
A surprising number of totally blind people also have some sort of degenerative hearing loss as a part of their condition. You know, those people who are congenitally blind. And I myself am in that position, so I have come to have a lot greater sympathy for people who go blind later in life, or who have degenerative conditions like RP, where they feel their sight slipping away, and can really understand why they would be hankering for any kind of cure or something to stop the outflow of their sight. But from my point of view, you know, I wouldn't want to try any kind of sight restoration technology if you paid me to. And as a writer yourself, I can see a very good plot for a novel where you'll get to a situation in maybe 10 or 20 years' time where people who are perfectly happy, well-adjusted, comfortable blind people lose all sorts of rights because they are choosing to be blind. And, you know, it could be quite a horrific scenario.
Actually, I've thought of that myself, where our technology gets to a point where many people are, we'll say, fixed, repaired, what have you, restored. What happens to the people who are left behind? They're going to be a very small community, or they could be a very small community, and may not have the clout that we have now. However, that's not a reason to prevent these technologies.
I guess it's another kind of a version of our 3C discussion, isn't it? In some ways.
Yeah, we're breaking up.
It's another version of our W3C discussions in some ways, really. You know, that that technology will keep evolving.
Well, I do believe that technology will keep evolving. You know, unless something happens to our civilization. We saw what happened on September 11th, but presumably our terrorist friends don't have anything bigger planned for us all. But, you know, science fiction, I've read a lot of science fiction in my life, and one of the themes in science fiction are cycles of civilization, rises and falls. And I would like to think that we're a ways away from our civilization falling. But I would not want to be a blind person through such a collapse.
Have you ever read a science fiction author called Dennis Danvers?
No.
Okay. Well, he wrote a couple of books. I think the first one was called Circuit to Heaven in this particular series, or Circuit of Heaven. But the concept was that computers had become so powerful that you could upload a virtual reality version of yourself to this great big computer they called the bin and live an eternal life. And there were a group of people, some of whom were of the far Christian right and others who just didn't like the idea, who resisted. And, you know, eventually civilization just broke down for those guys pretty much. But you do wonder at what point these sorts of technologies will develop a momentum of your own, and you're going to be considered a bit of a social outcast if you don't adopt them.
I think it is personal choice, but you raise a good point. What happens if we have technology that is capable of curing blindness and people choose not to avail themselves of that technology? Do we pay for them if they refuse to do that? Do we subsidize them? Do we support them in any way? I don't know. That's something, a question that society will have to answer. Bigger minds than mine will have to tackle that. But it's a good point. What if you choose not to avail yourself of this technology and everybody else moves on?
I think I would rather end my life than adopt that kind of technology personally. I think it would just be such an incredible change that I just wouldn't want to put myself through it.
I understand. I that's a very valid point. And I respect you for having that. I believe that if things really did change that much and you were confident that you could take part in this and that, yes, there would be change, but it would be change in a good way or at least change in a learning experience, that I think you might find yourself being tempted.
Interesting. The FDA in America are still not authorizing this procedure, I understand, so you have to go to Portugal to get it done?
Correct. The Federal Death Administration, I mean the Food and Drug Administration, is, and right. I will give them the benefit of the doubt. I mean, this is still too new. And I believe that it will become FDA approved within 3 to 5 years.
So does that mean that, you know, without getting too personal about it, that the $70,000 has to come out of your pocket to do this?
I'm willing to pay the money. I'm certainly willing to pay the money. I'm also looking at setting up a fund for this. I know I've spoken with people at the Association of Blind Citizens, and I know they have expressed interest in setting up a fund to explore these types of technologies and fund scientific research. I know that one of the gentlemen who had this procedure done raised money for himself and also for several other people through a veterans group in Louisiana where he was from. People will pay money to do this, and people will contribute money to something like this as long as they believe it's valid.
Well, I really hope that you will see fit to come back on the show when you've gone through the procedure and tell us all about it, because this time has flown by and we've actually... Oh, just as I was rounding off, we've got another call. So let me just get to that person. Hang on a second. It's area code number 336. You're speaking with Joe Lazaro. Hello there.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead. Did you have a question or comment? Well, apparently not. Well, Joe, I really appreciate you coming on the program. It's an hour and a half that has gone by very fast, and it's been fascinating. I hope that you'll come back on the program again and tell us how it all went.
I enjoyed it. If people want to write to me, they can certainly do so. Can I give my email address and my website?
Please do.
My email is Lazaro, LAZZARO, at theworld.com. And that was my attempt to be a little international there. I hope I did well.
So is that your domain name, is it?
I do have my domain actually is www.joelazaro.com.
Oh, very good. Okay. Okay.
But, I haven't figured out how yet to get my email sent to that domain, so I'm working on that now.
Oh, very good. So that's Lazaro, that's L-A-Z-Z or Z-Z-A-R-O at theworld.com if you want to get in touch.
Yes, or the website www.joelazaro, which is all one word, J-O-E, Lazaro, L-A-Z-Z-A-R-O.com.
Well,
I'd be happy to. And if people want information about Nobel, it's www.artificialvision.com.
Well, that's an easy domain, artificialvision.com. This has been just such great, I've been really stimulated and challenged by it, and I appreciate you coming on the program very much indeed.
Jonathan, thank you very much. You have a very, very good show. I've listened to it. You give out a lot of good information, and I think you're doing a very good service for people.
Thank you, Joe, and we'll speak again, I hope.
We will.
Best of luck.
All right, good night, Tom.
Okay, night-night. That's Joe Lazaro speaking to us from Massachusetts, and I hope we'll follow how Joe gets on with the artificial vision at the Nobel Institute, and you can go to the website if you're interested in that technology at www.artificialvision.com. You're listening to Blind Line, and it's as we speak live, it's 24 minutes before 3 Universal Time. We have about 20 minutes or so of the show remaining, and we'll open the board to any comments or questions that you have. You may want to continue the discussion that we've been having on the show today about artificial vision. Would you go for this? Would you not? Of course, it's very new technology, and I don't know even if you could quite call it 1.0 yet, really. Sort of like 0.5 alpha 2 or something. But as Joe says, it'll probably keep developing. These things have a habit of doing that. And I have no doubt there'll be alternatives. And there already are in the works, in fact, as Joe was talking about. So would you take this? Would you take it in its present form? And would you take it ever? If it was a 2020 option. If somebody offered you 2020 vision for $150,000, for example, would you go for that? You might want to discuss something else as well. Whatever's on your mind. Of course, JAWS 4.5 is due to go public beta this week sometime, so if you have any comments on what you heard in Main Menu last week or questions about that, you're welcome to give us a call. Other things happening in the blind community? Well, who knows, but you're welcome to share anything with us that you would like to. The number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And then when you're asked to enter a conference code, it's 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. The board is free, so if you give us a call now, you will get straight on the phone, on the program. I received some really interesting emails on the subject, actually, when I put the promotional email out last night to say that we were going to be doing this interview. So I hope that some of those people who submit some comments to me privately on the email will also give us a ring and share their thoughts about the whole artificial vision thing. You know, there are some people who desperately, desperately want it. I think particularly people who have developed sight loss as a result of an accident or some kind of degenerative condition. But one can't really generalize too much. There are certainly some totally blind people who are congenitally blind who want it badly too. Who just feel that blindness is just an absolute pain. So if you have any thoughts on that, you're most welcome to get in touch with us. Otherwise, I shall sing a number of popular Rayconniff tunes or something equally mundane to while away the time when we are off the air for another show. So that's area code 212-812-2800, and then the PIN, the conference code 0480-5512. And someone who's called in is from 615, which I believe is Nashville. Hello there.
Hello there, Jonathan.
Oh, it's Dr. Killian. How are you this evening?
Oh, I am attempting to do well.
Good, good, good. What's on your mind?
Well, first a question. Have we had that giveaway yet for WindowEyes?
Yeah, you must have missed the promotion at the beginning of the program. I can play it for you again if you like.
I would like to hear that.
Okay, listen to this. Oh. Well, it's going to make a liar out of me. Hang on. Doodle-doo-doo. Why doesn't it go? Well, you just have to talk amongst yourselves while I get it going for you. I'm sure it'll be worth the wait. You'll see. Oh, yes, here we go. So, okay, here we go.
ACB Radio Director giving you more chances to win and win big. Win big. Win big.
Hello.
Hi, can I speak with Bruce, please?
Excuse me.
Bruce, this is Jonathan Mosen calling you from ACB Radio Interactive.
Oh, hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. A while ago, you entered the GW Micro competition, you may remember, and you won yourself a talking clock.
I certainly do.
And you also got into the draw for a copy of Window Eyes Professional. And I'm very pleased to be able to tell you that, courtesy of GW Micro, you are the winner of Window Eyes Professional.
Fantastic.
Yes, it is you.
Great.
You have won that screen reader. It's a wonderful package, works in all kinds of versions of Windows. And GW Micro is going to be sending that to you in the next little while.
Oh, thank you so much.
Congratulations to Bruce Taves of Canada, the grand winner in our Window Eyes Professional giveaway. And congratulations to all of our winners who'll be receiving their prizes in the next little while. Thanks to GW Micro, the sponsors of the Eye Opener promotion. And stay tuned because there are even more exciting ways to win on the way.
All the wonderful personalities and great music, what's the place to listen to?
ACBRI.
Good on ya. Nice bit of production, that.
Well.
Yeah. But so that means that we are shipping out, we're getting those names to GW, as your president says, GW. And they will be shipping out the talking clocks and the T-shirts very shortly now.
That'd be very good.
Yeah.
Definitely looking forward to that clock.
Oh, yes. You'll be able to know what time it is.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. So, I've wound you down there. So what else is on your mind?
Well, I would like to tell you that if I had the chance to get my vision, even if it's done artificially, I would jump at it in a moment.
Yeah? Why is that?
Well, for one thing, I did have vision as a very young child up until I was about 8, 10 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And I would still very much like to have it. And one thing I could certainly do with it is teach newly sighted people how to see. Because that's the one thing they would need to have. Once you have the operation, that's only half the battle. Maybe not even half of it. Having the operation would be the relative easy part.
Yes.
The hard part would be teaching people how to see. Light is, what different colors are.
Yep.
What the different shapes are. All good stuff like that.
Yep, that's right. In the At First Sight movie, which I really recommend if anyone hasn't seen it, they found that they had to get this guy, like a rehabilitation teacher, a seeing teacher, to teach this guy exactly what you said, what it is to see, to interpret the signals that were now going into his brain.
That's right. I should point out that you are breaking up a little bit, so it's difficult.
Yeah, I know. This jolly old long-distance company, I think they've gone with a really cheap voice-over-internet thing to cut their costs, and unfortunately, it's the most reasonably priced option we have.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
The trick is to be right on top of the microphone.
Well, I know, but then it's
the louder you speak, the less breakup there is.
Trouble is, it's too loud for the listeners, you see, so what can you do? But what was I going to say to you? Yeah, see, now that's precisely the reason why I wouldn't accept it, because to me it would just be too much of an adjustment for someone who's never been able to see, and I don't think blindness is enough of a bother to warrant it.
Well, I think that you, especially someone with your intelligence, could be taught how to see. It would take a long time to do it, but you could be taught how to see. I think the rewards for that would be immense.
God, imagine reviewing something like that.
The biggest reward would be to be able to see your wife and children for the first time.
But I don't really want to. I mean, no disrespect to my wife and children, but I mean, I know them as I'm happy knowing them. But I mean, it would be a fun review for Main Menu, wouldn't it? You know, imagine doing a Main Menu review of a system like that.
It would be a Main Menu unlike any other.
It'd probably be the last Main Menu.
you know, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well, I appreciate you calling in as always, and we'll get that talking clock out to you soon.
And I shall talk to you next time then.
Good on you. Okay then.
Great.
Bye now.
Bye.
Well, let's go back to area code 559. Hello.
Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, Pam. How's it going?
Hey. Oh, pretty good. By the way, Dave wanted me to say to you that he didn't mean to hang up so abruptly, but when there are calls backed up and you do let him know, he simply wants to get off so that other people can in fact.
That's no problem. Well, I hope he got my congratulations anyway.
Well, he's up the whole evening, but she's very, he really looked like more of a month-old baby. Was in fact 9 pounds, 5 ounces.
Yeah, that big man.
And, oh, yeah, and her skin, she doesn't have some of the baby newborn attributes. Her skin is soft. She's just, like I say, I could talk about, I'm beginning to know what people, how people feel like when they say, oh, God, not any, yeah. not more grandchild, not more grandchild pictures.
Yeah, well, because she was a bit overcooked. Yeah, Richard was 9 pounds 8 when he was 9 pounds 13 rather when he was born.
Oh my!
He was a huge man.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, yeah. All of our babies have been on the large side. I don't know where they get it from either, because we're only tiny people.
Oh dear. And the thing was that when he finally came along, let's just say there was no way that Jenny could be given anything beyond the induction to deaden the pain. She had to go through it all.
Yeah.
But she did quite, she did really well.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what I was going to say regarding, you guys were bringing me down memory lane with the apple. I mean, didn't we think we were just wonderful when we had that 128K, including expansion card?
Yeah, I know. It's fun talking about that stuff. And it makes you wonder, somebody's going to be around in 20 years' time communicating in goodness knows what kind of medium, saying, I started out with a 2 gigahertz machine, and in those days we thought that was fast.
That's for true.
Yeah.
And another thing, I remember I could not understand the concept of memory. What I couldn't understand was why the Echo would stop speaking, or why it would go into these kind of squealy voices before it would quit, until I read a tactic article, and Frederick Gassoni compared the memory and the function of the speech synthesizer to the memory was a little house, and Mr. Echo was a little man living in the house, and when too many programs came along, Mr. Echo would get pushed out of his house. It was adorable, but that was easy. And friends of mine, I guess Mr. Echo got pushed out of his house again. But we learned it.
Yeah.
I'm in an interesting situation right now that's kind of fun and kind of scary is too strong a word. I've been communicating with a young lady who is using FreedomBox, and she also has, she's using the software version.
Mm-hmm.
And she's also trying to learn the internet. And she's asking me questions that fully indicate that she really does not understand A, the internet, or B, JAWS. And what we're telling her is that she really needs to go and download those JAWS tutorials. And she doesn't know really what function the mouse has. She doesn't understand. There are certain sites that she says are impossible. And they're really not, just doesn't know what to do. I click on it, and it just keeps going round and round and round. Why can't I just, I can hear the, I know where the buttons are on the mouse. Why can't I just click it like a sighted person? I mean, she really does not know, does not understand. I'm trying to explain my level best. I'm certainly no educator. And I was telling Dave some of this, and he said she really needs to go and download those cassettes or those tutorials and study them. And I'm going to tell her that. I'm also going to tell her that she needs to consider Kathy Ann's tutorials, the ones that are on Main Menu.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of stuff there on Main Menu if she can get to it.
She's really in a pickle, and she gets frustrated, and I can understand why.
But there are a lot of people who don't or won't or can't use those training tapes for whatever reason. I think that they're pretty good, and they give you a good grounding. They used to be horrible, and then over the years they've got very good. And I don't quite know why people, so many people I come across, are reluctant to use those. Maybe it's a learning style thing that some people just can't learn that way.
Could be. Well, I think what I will do, and again, I'm no instructor. I think maybe I'll suggest that you try that, and we can maybe go over some of this together. And I may go ahead and do the same thing myself, because heaven knows it wouldn't hurt. And Dave is thinking he'll reread them himself, and we might be able to help this young lady. But I am finding people are, again, we've talked about this a lot, people are having to learn the difference between, and this is not the not freedom box, let me say this right up front, but people have had a difficult time knowing what freedom box can do and what must be done on the net. It's quite an interesting experience.
Well, of course, there is a browser right in Freedom Box. I think that particular component needs a bit of work, but you know, you can surf the web and stuff with the Freedom Box.
Yeah. Well, they're going to have to get frames handled, and there's a bit of work that's going to have to be done.
Yeah.
I just hope they'll persevere.
I agree. I think at the moment the browser is the weakest. Weakest link in Freedom Box.
I think you are right.
But they'll probably get there. I mean,
Tina, the person who received the Freedom Box from ACB Radio, maybe you can explain this, or from Sendero. Or what the hell am I talking about? Pardon my French.
Cerotech.
Cerotech. I can never remember their name. She tried to answer a Yahoo mail. A Yahoo message, and all she could hear was the Yahoo ad.
Huh. How interesting.
I wonder, you know, any idea what was going on there, and I couldn't tell her.
No, although the tech support people seem to be pretty good, but,
yeah,
well,
that's what I told her.
I've got to do one more call before the show finishes, so you guys look after yourselves.
Say again?
Look after yourselves and have a wonderful week.
Sure will. You too.
Thank you, Pam.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. And
Jonathan, hello, it's Lois.
Hello, Lois, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you. A couple of quick things. I know we're near the end of the hour.
Mm.
First of all, I found the program very interesting, and Joel Lazaro's project very interesting.
Yeah.
You know, you sound like me, or I like you. I'm a pretty happy, contented, blind person. Blindness is my lot in life.
Yeah.
And to me, the idea of wiring something into my brain has horrifying prospects.
Well, you know, I wouldn't mind it in some situations. If I could have a device that could be wired right in my brain that gave me high-fidelity sound piped directly, say, from a DVD into my eardrum, I'd go for that. Man, I would. I'd be really into that. I mean, just imagine it. But no, I don't know. It's just having sight. And I don't at all decry people who have a desperate desire for it either, because I think I relate to it in other ways. But having sight just doesn't interest me in the slightest.
Yeah, I agree. And no, I don't at all decry people wanting this at all. But Now, I had a little bit of sight until I was 4 or 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But losing what there was so young, I settled in and learned how to live with total blindness.
Mm.
And like you, it just doesn't bother me. And I don't. It sounds crazy. I wouldn't go to that much trouble, at least not in the stage it's at now.
Yeah, I think I'm getting too old for that sort of change in my life, you know.
Yeah, feeling the same way, and I'm older than you. Anyhow, the other thing, what Pam was just talking about.
Yes.
You know, as you know, I started with computers about 2 years ago, and pretty much on my own.
Yeah,
and
you've caught on pretty quickly.
Yeah, well, oh, there's still things where I'm at sea, but I'll tell you what, you've got to do your homework, and a lot of it. And one of the biggest helps to help me understand the Windows concept and the and why things are done certain ways was a book. I don't know about the lady that Pam and Dave are trying to help. If she's a Braille reader, is totally blind or what, even if she's not a Braille reader, there's something that might help her. There's a book that, do you know about the book from National Braille Press that they did a few years ago, a Windows 95 Explained?
Well, who wrote that?
It's a British book.
Is that the Sarah Morley one, or is that her name, Sarah?
Yeah. Sarah Morley.
Yeah, good
That's
book.
Correct.
Very good book, yeah.
Yeah, but
excellent.
There are diagrams with it that are very well done and show you what Windows looks like.
Yeah, yeah.
You can buy the diagrams, and those taught me a lot.
Yeah, Doug
now
Wake,
there's a Windows...
Doug Wakefield did a similar thing, where there was a little thermoform-type book that showed you what the menu bar, you know, where the menu bar looked like and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, for me, as a non-visual person, I don't really mind what it looks like, but for some people it's important, and the Sarah Morley book was very well written.
Yes, and the diagrams were excellent. The reason I got it is because, like you, I'm not so concerned about what it looks like. I don't much care. I want to know how to work it. But when somebody says, now there's a window here, and even the JAWS tutorials, they're telling you there's a menu bar here and there's a status bar there, and I'm thinking, bar schmar. And when you're talking to other people, they talk with sighted terminology, with visual things.
Yeah.
And so this was quite an education. This helped me understand a lot more when I'm looking and learning how to do things from people that are not connected with blindness and how we access things.
Well, I find that we as blind people actually seem to know a bit more about the way that Windows works and what the controls are than sighted people sometimes. You don't often, unless you're talking to programmers, hear the average sighted person talking about radio buttons and combo boxes and list views. So I find
that
quite interesting.
Yes, I have that trouble. I actually tell a few sighted people how to do some things, and I have to tell them about things that are elementary to me now.
Yes, yeah.
But like, they click around with a mouse, and half of them don't realize what they're doing. They look at something and click it with the mouse, and they don't know a radio button from a dialog box.
There you go. Well, you've very nicely timed us out to the end of the show, Lois. It's lovely to hear from you, and I think it's a credit to you the way that you've come to grips with Windows and stuff, so you're a model that others should follow.
Hey, you're part of the success. When I got on to ACB Radio, when I got brave enough to get online, I learned a lot from you and the ACB people, too, there, your broadcasting team. So thank you and everybody else where I've received help. And have a good evening.
Thank you. Lovely
to... It's afternoon where you are.
It is. It's nearly 3 o'clock in the afternoon now.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Well, have a good one.
Thanks very much, Lois. You too. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye now. And that wraps up the program. The Snowman is going to be on tomorrow operating for John Wiedlich because I'm otherwise engaged. So that'll be nice. But I will be back next week, and we should have another excellent guest schedule. Looks like that's all teed up, so we'll tell you more about that later in the week. Appreciate your calls and your tuning in. And thanks for being a part of Blind Line.
For the latest breaking news stories, visit the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org. All the news, all the time. From the world's leading news organizations like CNN, the BBC, the New York Times, the Toronto Star, the Wall Street Journal, and more. That's all the news, all the time, in the ACB Radio newsroom at www.acbradio.org.